Okay. Welcome. Thank you all for being here this afternoon. Just covering the basics here. My name is Bob Wrench, and we're going to talk about preparing for the, that should have said 341 and 342 exams. I guess I made that mistake. But we're covering both exams this afternoon. For purposes of introduction, my name is Bob Wrench. Last name is pronounced like the tool. Easy way to remember that. My middle name is Alan. That's true. I got my grandfather's first names. I got my grandfather's middle names, which I'll take because I could have got their first names. Then I'd be Siegfried Francis. So Bob, Alan, I'm fine with that. Jumping on in, we're going to cover an overview here. I'm going to pass it off to David Alfassi, and then he's going to pass it back to me. But just to let you know, we're talking about 341 and 342. We're going to take a look at some question samples. They're going to be in the neighborhood of what you might see in the exchange exams. I will talk with you about some of the feedback I got from some of my students. This exam has been revised a couple of times since I saw it back in the day, but got an idea that there's some things that have definitely changed about it. And I also do want to share with you some resources that I've discovered. I do try and keep this as conversational as possible. I'm not a formal lecturer. I'm a technical trainer, so I do like to keep the repartee going. I'm going to pass this off to David here for a moment. He's going to talk about Microsoft certification and some of the things that you can expect to see with the new exam format. David?
Yesterday I made the mistake that I walked by right in front of the speaker over there, and there was a really nasty noise that came out, so I learned my lesson. I come the other way around now. I'm just going to take a few minutes to talk to you guys about certification, some of the things that have changed in the past few years with Microsoft certification. I'm going to talk to you about how the exams have changed, how some of the content has changed. Those of you who may have sat in one of these sessions with me before, let me know because I'm going to change my jokes. I promise, not the same jokes. Please raise your hand if you've heard this before. A couple people, two people. All right, perfect. For you guys, three people. For you guys, I'm changing it up. All new material. It wasn't good the first time. It's not going to be good this time either. Basically, what I want to tell you is how your expectations should be shifted appropriately to the level of the exams. Some of the reputations or the things that you've heard about Microsoft certification exams have changed a lot in the last few years. So I just want to make sure you don't have any misconceptions or preconceived notions about the way things are, and you understand about the level of depth of difficulty, especially, of these exams. The rigor is probably the biggest thing that has changed in Microsoft certification exam in the last few years. And how do we achieve that rigor? Well, we really tell our exam writers to make the questions much more challenging. The differentiating bar between qualified and unqualified has been raised a lot. So we want to make sure that when you pass the exam, you are truly a certified person. I know a lot of people that have taken these exchange exams have failed because they walked in with the previous expectations of, you know, taking the exam on Exchange 2007. They walked in, they found it pretty easy. They went in over to do Exchange 2013. And they're like, wow, that was a lot more challenging than it was in previous versions. Also, a lot of the concepts that have been around since Exchange 2007, such as the PowerShell management of Exchange, those have been around for quite some time. So now, that level of familiarity is already there. So we're not going to test you on basic PowerShell Exchange commandlet concept. We're going to go way beyond that and much more deeper than that. And Bob will cover that technical aspect. So the rigor is something that you guys need to be ready for, no doubt about it. Also, we've improved the relevance of these exams. And the way we've improved the relevance is by ensuring that the questions that we're asking are actually relevant things that you would do in a real Exchange environment. If nobody is using a specific feature of Exchange, well, we don't test about those features that nobody uses, that you would never encounter in the real world. We use a formula that we call 80-80, which is 80% of the people use this tool 80% of the time. So that's kind of a formula that we use in development. Now, we go beyond that also in the types of questions that we ask, and I'll talk about that in a few minutes. Something else that we do in order to improve relevance is we fight piracy. So piracy is something that has been a major challenge for Microsoft certification over the last few years, where people go, they take exams, and then they post the questions on the internet. So there's various things that we do to fight piracy, some things we're allowed to talk about, and some things we don't. But one of the things that we do, and that we tell people, is that we constantly refresh the content. There's constantly new questions added to the pools. So it's very likely that whatever stuff you encounter on the internet is not what's going to be in the exam, because we're constantly fighting that. And we monitor that. We monitor what's going on the internet to make sure that we remove some of the information that's on the internet, and also protect the content that's on the live exams. In terms of the certifications, you might have heard MCSA, MCSC came back a couple of years ago. They were replaced with the MCTS, or Technology Specialist, and IT Pro certifications. MCSC now are focused on specific breadth of technology. So in order to attain an MCSC, you need to start off with your base layer. Your base coat is your MCSA. So once you apply your MCSA coat, on top of that, you put your MCSC specialization. So MCSCs come in different flavor. You've got private cloud, you've got Link, you've got SharePoint, and of course, you've got Exchange. To attain each one of those MCSCs, it's two exams, and those two exams are the ones that Bob will be talking about today, 341, 342. Your MCSA is three exams. So you can come in Windows 2008 flavor or Windows Server 2012 flavor. We've got MCSD also for developers, though. I don't think any of you guys are developers in here. New item types. There are two types of questions that are completely different from one exam to the next if you're taking 341 and 342. 341 will have the standard multiple choice questions that you guys are familiar with. They'll also have hot area questions where you can click different areas on the screen. They also have drag and drops where you drag objects from one area to another. And they will have, and 342 will then have new item types or different item types. And the main one that you need to watch out for is the build list item type. The build list item type is the one where you have to choose four or five different actions from a list of actions and then put them to another area and then organize them in the appropriate order. So not only do you have to choose which objects, but then you have to also order them in the appropriate order. So typically these are tasks. These would never be wizards. So these would never be the steps of a wizard. These would be real actions, you know, such as in which order do you deploy these Exchange roles? Do you deploy your CAS first, your mailbox, your hub, in which order based on whatever requirements you have? Then you've got your case studies. Now, the case studies are lengthy details of information about an environment, anywhere from 5 to 8 pages of notes about an environment. And then you get 10 very short questions that follow that. So the questions are actually very, very short, but they all relate back to the information that's in the case study. Okay? You will only find build list and case study items in exam 342. 341 will include everything else. Some exam tips, some basics. Just remember that you'll probably have anywhere from 40 to 60 questions in your exam, so pace yourself in terms of time. The passing score is always 700. Now, 700 is a, we get often this question, what does 700 mean? Well, 700 is kind of a mathematical baseline that we set as a passing score, but it means different things in different exams, which means that sometimes you need to get 28 questions right in one exam to pass, and in another exam, you need 34 questions right to pass. It doesn't matter. We don't tell you how many questions you need to pass. You don't get to find that information out. You just need to know you get to get to that magical 700 number. It's more or less 70%. And people often ask me, like, how much questions I really need to get right? Well, we have statistical processes that we go through to determine that, but it's about 70%. Hi, Beth. I didn't see you back there. I understand your technology challenged, yes. One important thing is that you can move between questions inside of an exam. So I can actually go back and review questions that I've answered before. You cannot move between case studies. So once you've finished the 10 questions in a case study and you move on to the next case study, you cannot open up the previous case study again. So that's something you need to be aware of as you're moving through the questions in your exam. You don't get any negative marks. What does that mean? It means that if you don't know the answer to a question and you have no clue and you have no more time and you have no way of knowing the answer to that question, just guess. Leaving a question blank actually doesn't help you at all. But getting an answer wrong doesn't have negative points. So you might as well guess and move on to the next question. Also, every question is weighed equally. What that means is that if you have a question that's very, very long and another question that's very, very short, they are worth the same thing on the exam. Okay? So if you only have 1 minute left and you've got two questions left, pick the shorter one, whichever one you're going to be most familiar with. Something that's great about Microsoft certification exams is every single question is kind of built with the same skeleton, the same baseline. Now, what we mean by that is that every item writer, every question writer has a specific template that they need to formulate, to use, to ensure that the questions follow that specific format. So that we have specific expectations for you guys. When you're looking at a question, you should be able to rip out or pull out the important information easily. And the way we do this, we have an anatomy of an exam question. So every single exam question always starts with the same bit of information, which we call a business problem. The business problem is an overarching goal, such as you plan to deploy Exchange Server 2013 on your network. It's an overarching goal. In there, you also have information about your environment. It tells you, well, you have a server that runs Windows Server 2012. You have an Active Directory domain that is in Windows Server 2008, a functional mode. You have all this information about your lay of the land. And then you have a goal statement. Now, the goal statement always starts with the same three words, you need to. You need to do something. You need to install Exchange Server 2013 on a server named Server 1. It's a very specific goal. And then your answer will refer back to that goal statement. It will say, on Server 1, run setup.exe. Okay? So you will have your correct answer that will always refer back to that you need to statement. Everything else in the question is there to support the you need to statement. So when you're looking at a question, that piece of information that you're really trying to rip out in terms of what is the action I'm trying to perform is the you need to statement. Okay? Everything else is there to make sure that what's wrong is really wrong and what's right is really right. It's just technical information. You need to, that's the goal of what you're trying to achieve. So then you get your correct answer, your incorrect answers, which you at least have two incorrect answers minimum, and you have at least one correct answer, hopefully. An important point you guys need to know, we're not trying to trick you. We do not want you guys to get tripped up on the exam questions. It's a big misconception people have that we're trying to trick exam takers. Absolutely not. Usually when people write questions and try to trick the exam testers, who they're tricking is actually the qualified people. The guy that actually knows the technology but gets tripped up because he's reading too much into it and he gets tricked out because the difference between server and servers is something he didn't pick up on that additional S. And he'll get tricked up on that. And if you are qualified and you fail an exam, then we fail as a certification program to give you a certification that you can use to demonstrate your skills. So I want people who are not qualified, I want them to fail very badly. But even more importantly, I want people who are qualified to pass the exam and to become certified. So we are definitely not trying to trick you. We're not trying to trip you up with the exam questions. All right? So with that, I'm going to pass it back to Mr. Bob, who's going to talk to you about all the beautiful, interesting stuff of Exchange Server 2013.
Yeah, but let me point out one thing. Those of you who might be familiar with David's work, he's probably considerably more qualified to do this discussion than I am. How many of you have the Mastering Exchange Server 2013 book?
Starting from the sales on Amazon, not too many people.
Author. So, well, I did, four chapters?
Yes, Bob is a co-author of Mastering.
Yeah, I put contributing author. Thank you, David. And seriously, that's the guy I go to when I get questions I can't answer. I'm glad we're Facebook friends.
So am I.
No, seriously, he's one of the coolest guys I know in the industry, and
It still bothers him when I call him fun size. So anyway, all right, so getting back on topic. By the way, I'd like to welcome a few of my other friends that are here. Oh, Beth, stop. Okay, so those of you that have pursued exchange certification over the last few years may have sat this session last year. I also did Exchange 2010 for a couple of years before that. But yeah, today we got 70-341, 70-342 to earn your MCSC for messaging. You do need to have your 410, 411, and 412 under your belt, or you can take the 417 roll-up, which covers both 410, 411, and 412, and those three cover everything you need to get into all of the server-based MCSE certifications. So it's going to help you out with whether you're doing desktop infrastructure, server, messaging, communication, all of those. So, covering that, who's a candidate for this? Your full-time admins and other professionals that may be consulting, may be trainers, may be people that are responsible for supporting Exchange on a daily basis. Recommended 3 years of experience administering, deploying, managing, monitoring, upgrading, migrating, and designing Exchange servers. A lot of this does have to do with migration from down-level versions, whether it's Exchange 2007 or Exchange 2010. Keep in mind that you do not, Microsoft is supporting an N-2 approach when it comes to upgrades. So if you are running Exchange Server 2003, you're going to have to get to 2007 or 2010 before you can roll over to 2013. So that's an issue for some folks, I know. So let's talk about this bar right here. You know, there's that old joke, Bob walks into a bar, it's right there on the floor. Okay, so we'll talk about this. This is the thing that you will notice whenever you go out to Microsoft's website, and it starts breaking down the exam specifications. So it breaks down planning, installing, configuring, and destroying hardware with a cup. Okay, that was not intended. Would you get, are there paper towels back there? Thanks, please. Okay, step away from the table. So when you go out and you take a look at www.microsoft.com, and then it starts breaking down the specific exam, this is what you're going to come across. It'll also break down the sub-steps, which we'll break into as well. So those are the four primary areas, broken down fairly evenly on the 341 side of it. We'll first of all jump into the message transport side. And you know what I did? I changed that, and I forgot to change it on this other slide. It says planning high availability for common scenarios, and it mentions intra-site redundancy, making sure that you've got backup in various locations. Transport dumpster is the term that we used in Exchange 2007 and 2010. Now it's the safety net. So that is actually something that I had changed and I forgot to. That save option is so important sometimes. So anyway, transport dumpster, shadow redundancy, which another feature that will pop up because it has to do with the way messages get removed from the system after they've been successfully delivered. Thank you for that. We got a pink spot in the middle of the table. And let's see. I'm better off out here where I can get away from destroying things up in the front. Then we also get into MX records for round robin, etc. Designing a transport solution, whether the messages are moving within a site or between sites. Domain security and transport layer security. Edge transport. Now, see, that's one of the things that'll pop up. People say, well, wait a second. Exchange 2013 doesn't have an edge server. That's true. But it does integrate with Exchange, the edge server role from 2007 and 2010. Now, one of the things you will want to make sure that you are familiar with is how that synchronizes with Exchange Server 2013 when it ties in with the mailbox server. Message hygiene, shared namespace, all of those important. We get into configuring and managed transports, edge server configuration, all your connectors, transport rules, accepted domains, some of the pretty common stuff. You know, really for a lot of these things, they haven't changed too much going from 2010 to 2013. Where it has changed is primarily in the interface, because we've gone to that web-style interface that you'll get used to seeing in Exchange Server 2013, as well as Office 365 if you've gone to the Exchange Online version. So common interface there. Address rewriting, email policies, all there, anti-spam, anti-malware, and how we can turn those agents on. So before we start diving into these, and I'd cause a hazard. Okay, make sure I'm not standing in the pool of water when the short circuit happens, right? So I'm big on resources. You know, I'm a trainer. So it's important for me to make sure that I'm pointing in the right direction. The 70-341 course and the 70-342 course are good courses. I think they teach a lot of the practical elements that people need to do the job. This certification exam, however, requires a little bit more. So the resources that I think are most important to you are going to be those that Microsoft provides. Taking a look at technet.microsoft.com, it's critical from my perspective to make sure that you know to go to Products, Exchange Server, and then take a look at Exchange 2013. And you've got all these various subsections here. There's a lot of great material in here. But what I find myself referring people to day in and day out and bringing up in my classes that I teach on a regular basis is going here to the library. If somebody came up to me and said, hey, I want one source, one place to go to get everything that I need to pass this certification exam, where would I steer somebody? And it's right here. Jump into the Exchange subsection, start right here, work your way down. It's in there. You know, David was talking about some of the exam question styles. My advice to you, learn everything you need to know about Exchange, and then learn how to do it from PowerShell. That has been the thing that I keep getting as far as feedback from my students about what has made or broken their attempts at passing this particular certification exam. You have to know each command. You have to know when a command pipes into another command, which command is right. When do I use get mailbox versus get mailbox database? Okay? The other side of it that you're going to want to take away from this, you need to know your arguments. The switches, they're going to throw, So I had a, when I took this exam, this has been revised twice since the Exchange 2013 first came out. You know, it's not, some exams are almost exactly like the beta. This one is far removed from that. So the warning, and this is what it was described, how it was described to me. You get a question, and it's a blank. You hit the pull-down arrow. You have three different options as far as the first part of a PowerShell commandlet. That will then pipe into two other commands, and you not only have to pick the right command to achieve the goal, you have to pick the right argument. For some folks, I know that on a day-to-day basis, they may not be doing as much with PowerShell. Actually, that's one of the things I really liked about Exchange 2007 and 2010, is that you could run through a wizard, and look, you've got the PowerShell commandlet right at the end of the wizard. Now you're going to have to take a look at the admin logs and take a look at what's popping up in the administrative logs to show you the PowerShell commands that ran. but you got to mirror yourselves. This is what I do when I'm running through the graphical user interface. This is the same command that I would execute if I were doing the whole thing in PowerShell once again. So you got to go out here. You got to take a look at some of these options. You're going to want to take a look at, okay, most of the time when you take a look in the library here, it's going to show you both ways to do things. It'll talk about, you select this option in the menu, this option, then this option to get it done. But typically towards the bottom, it will also describe the commandlet that you would run to get it executed in PowerShell as well. Now what I've done here, going back and taking a look at the sample questions that we've got to work with, what I try to do is, I don't care about these sample questions. Does that sound crass? You're not going to see these questions on the certification exam. But there's a lot of really good resources. I asked earlier who had the Mastering Exchange Server 2013 book. One of the things that the publisher asked David, myself, J. Paul Brzezi, and a few other authors to do with when we were working on this book, at the end of each module, they asked us to come up with some questions pertaining to the content that we saw in that book. And hey, I'm not trying to sell you books. If you can get it from your public library, get it from your public library, okay? It's a good book to read. Sit down at Barnes & Noble, still in business. Borders is gone, right? Okay, so go to your Barnes & Noble, grab a copy, grab a cappuccino, sit down, go through the book, check out what's in the back. Go through the questions, but what I would ask you to do, don't necessarily focus on that's the answer to that question. What I would ask you to do, take a look at all of the answers and understand when each answer is appropriate for a different question. Here we see this. You're the exchange administrator for your Exchange 2013 organization. You want to ensure that all messages sent to users outside your organization contain the sender's name, address, division, telephone number, and mobile phone number at the bottom of the message along with a standard disclaimer. Notice what we've got here. New journal rule. New transport rule. Get mailbox. Specify the disclaimer text and AD attributes of the sender in the delivery tab of the send connector. One of those is, you know, close is as bright as it's going to get within this context. But what I would tell you, know what each of those do, because each of those answers is going to be the right answer for some question. It may not just be this question. Does that make sense? Yeah. I didn't write that part. Okay. Maybe that was David. I don't know. No, I'm kidding. But so as I was going through this, and we get this part, and then we get transport rules, this is what I would steer you towards. It's not about the question. It is about the answers. Everything that you can possibly find in the library section of TechNet is the answer to some question. So that's what I'd ask you to take away from that. Oh, the decks will be online tomorrow. You can pull it down. See if you'll take pictures. It's like, no, if you're going to take the picture, at least here. Okay. It's all about the entertainment factor anyway. So, another example. Well, I'm running around a lot. I feel like I'm getting winded. Is it the humidity? So, you're the exchange administrator for your organization. The CIO wants to ensure that information concerning new products in development does not leak to the media or competitors. You must develop a plan to prevent your users from forwarding messages that contain the name of a product under development to users outside the organization. What should you configure? Well, here we go. Create a single remote domain entry. Single transport rule with the appropriate RMS template. Single journal rule with the appropriate RMS template. A single journal rule. Apparently you have Tony Siragusa working at your company. Apparently he's leaking a little. So, I guess not everybody gets that joke. Okay. But anyway, we know that in this case, it's going to be a transport rule. We need to have some background with rights management services. And once again, we've got this link that I gave you here covers everything about information management. But that ties in with all the little things we need to know. It's not something that maybe everybody needs to implement every day of the week, but even in the middle of the Midwest, we've come across situations where we need to worry about implementing the protection of intellectual property. So we get into the mailbox rule, we start getting into planning things, database sizes, storage performance requirements, virtualization requirements, capacity, public folder placement. Oh, by the way, that reminds me, public folders. Has the public folder migration session happened yet? Was this morning? Yes, okay. Hopefully they'll repeat that one, because that has been one of the topics that seems to pop up all the time relative to Exchange 2013. Public folder migration. Jet stress, configuring and managing offline address books, public folders, mailbox server roles, address lists. I want to say Campbell Gunn was doing a session too on Exchange, wasn't he? Was he doing on Link? Deploying and managing high availability solutions. Working with DAGs, DAG networks, configuring placement of file share witnesses, manage mailbox database copies. One of the things that I put at the end of this slide deck as far as additional resources are the links to Scott Schnoll's sessions. Go. If you want to hear somebody talk about high availability and failover and resiliency, I cannot recommend Scott Schnoll's sessions highly enough. As far as the guy lives, eats, and breathes Exchange, so I would recommend that to anybody. He's going on right now. Is he right next door? Oh, say, I was wondering if you could hear me. Scott doesn't think real highly of me, but you know, it's. I want to recommend him. Anyway, so monitoring and troubleshooting mailbox rules, we get into replication, replay, copy activation, etc. And then we also want to cover, obviously, backup and recovery is going to be an important part of just about anything that we have to worry about. So managing lag copies. When it gets into lag copies, you will need to spend a little time with PowerShell. Dial tone restores, that's kind of the default. Item level recovery, public folder hierarchies, recovering mailbox servers, creating and configuring mail-enabled objects, mailboxes, scheduling team mailboxes, distribution lists and linked mailboxes as well when you have to worry about implementing Federation trusts. Manage mail-enabled object permissions. So you got mailbox folders, mailbox permissions. Now, that's kind of an interesting topic for discussion, is the idea about managing. There's a separation in the way that permissions are going to be handled along multiple mechanisms within Exchange 2013. Whether it has to do with folders, whether it has to do with send and receive permissions. So, you know, full control, send on behalf of, they're all different permissions that serve a different purpose. So that takes a little bit of getting used to. It's a little bit more, I would say a little bit more complex, but a little bit more, I don't want to use the term rigor. A higher degree of integrity than what we might have seen in the past as far as managing permissions and access. So once again, we get into the question. So you're an Exchange administrator for your organization. You plan to open another location that'll be that will be a separate AD site. You need to ensure that the mailbox servers in the new site have high availability. So you need to plan the RAID types and the volumes of the mailbox servers. So we get these different RAID solutions that are listed up here, and they all have their place. But when we start getting into it, one of the things that I wanted to steer you towards was the page that discusses all of the different RAID solutions and where you would choose to implement them. That's part of the Exchange library. So that's what I took you to here, the Exchange storage configuration options. Then we start getting into, oh, this was a friend of mine. I like this. Okay, for those of you that might be from New Zealand, you might know James Finley. But James had a pretty good time writing these, and he's originally from Omaha, so if he knew I was giving the presentation, I'm sure he would have given me a little bit of a hard time about it. You're the Exchange Administrator for Finley Tech. You have Exchange 2013 in a single domain AD Forest. Your headquarters are in Auckland, but you have branches in Omaha, Chicago, and Singapore. You need to make it easier to find email information for recipients from a different branch. The solution should not prohibit finding a recipient if you do not know what branch they work in. Users working remotely should be able to send emails to recipients even if they are not connected to the Finley Tech network. What should you do? Choose two to create a complete solution. So you get set up three accepted domains, one for each branch, set up three remote domains, one for each branch, set up three address lists, one for each branch, global address lists, email address policies, offline address books, and manage folder mailbox policies. And that's where Jim decided to go with, obviously, address list, one for each branch, and three offline address books. But once again, this is where you have to take a look at, hey, here's all these different answers. They've all got to be correct in some situation. So we have to know when and how we configure accepted domains, remote domains, global address lists, customizing those address lists, working with email address policies as well as offline address books. How are we doing so far? Are you getting something out of this? I care. I'm a trainer. That's my job. I get paid to care. That was weird. Was that too weird? Okay. I'm not going to get that touchy-feely. Don't worry about that. I stay in my aisle. Okay. So anyway, we have to worry about client access as well. It's no news to anybody, some of the changes that took place, obviously, from going from Exchange Server 2010 to Exchange Server 2013. We went from, when we went from 2003 to 2007, I thought that was brilliant. The fact that we got away from having a single server solution. You know what I'm talking about? Yes, the scalability was rancid. And we had, you know, it just did not scale well. You had a front-end server, you had a back-end server. Not a great, it didn't seem to work for me. We went to 2007 and 2010, obviously, when you have these different roles. So you had mailbox servers, client access servers, hub transport servers, unified messaging servers, edge transport servers. And the idea there was scalability. And somewhere along the line, we started taking a look at it and going, maybe we didn't need to go quite that far. Bring it back in a little bit. I'm not going to say this is a front-end, back-end environment, but you have client access servers, you have mailbox servers, you have hub transport services. We've got unified messaging services. So when we're setting up our CAS, that's going to be handling the majority of all of the clients that are going to be going through the Exchange environment have to go through the CAS, whether it's anything from Exchange ActiveSync, Outlook Anywhere, Outlook Web App, POP3, IMAP4. Sorry, I still say it like that. You know what I've noticed is that I joke about POP3 and IMAP4, but at the same time, it's not really a joke because we still have so many services that seem to depend on those protocols. Outlook, you know, just our regular Outlook clients are going through there. And yeah, there have been some things that have changed as far as the way that we're going to be interacting with that client access server. So We have to worry about our namespaces, URLs, certificates, certificates, certificates. 10 years ago, I would have looked at, certificates. And now they are such a part of everything that we have to manage on a regular basis, whether it has to do with, what doesn't use a certificate? We can use assigned certificates to clients. We can use certificates for managing IPsec tunnel endpoints. We use them everywhere. So it's something that's, if you know anybody at Microsoft, tell them, we'd really like to see another public key infrastructure class come out. Beth, write that down, please. We need another PKI class. Maybe, think we can get Komar on that sometime? No, he's okay. Brian Komar's the guy that wrote the security guide for Microsoft years ago. Authentication, and we have to worry about auto discover. Managing mobility solutions, whether it's deploy mobile OWA. I've never actually used that acronym myself, calling it MOWA. It sounds like somebody from Boston describing their lawn care. Configuring OWA policies, active sync policies, allow block quarantine, that's all pretty standard. I like this one. Apparently the apps for Office, the little ones like the ones that allow you to link and find automatic time with a map or something, they're called agaves. That was the term they used in beta. So sometimes if you hear the term agave, you know, apparently in this context, it does not have anything to do with tequila. Unfortunately. Then we get into load balancing, namespace, SIP load balancing, layer 7, layer 4, and Windows network load balancing. If I recall correctly, I had somebody hint to me that this part of it about the layer 4 and layer 7 load balancing was something that they had some difficulty with in the exam. So, because I remember getting a question about it. He didn't say it was specifically on the exam, but I think they're strongly hinting that they got something about it. Troubleshooting client connectivity. Well, it depends on the client. A lot of it's going to be based on web. So Outlook Anywhere, POP3 and IMAP4, authentication issues that pop up, web services, auto discover, and mobile devices. So then we get back into the sample questions once again. You need to secure OWA with a mutual authentication solution. What should you do? Require certificate-based authentication on the OWA virtual directory and all client access servers and issue smart cards to all users. Require certificate-based authentication on the OWA virtual directory for all internet-facing client access servers and issue smart cards to all users. I'm down with the smart cards. Use certificate-based authentication for all internet-facing mailbox servers and issue client certificates to all users. Well, yeah, but how are you going to get the users? How are you getting those certificates to the users, especially when you're going through Outlook web app, internally or externally? And deploying a proxy server in the perimeter network and recommending certificates. And there we start getting back into using smart cards. So what I've got here is some information on digital certificates and SSL, as well as smart cards. And then you're the administrator of an Exchange Server 2013 organization that has a single Active Directory domain in 3 locations. CIO asks you to deploy Office 2013 to all client computers. More users will be using mobile devices to check their email than in the past. You have to plan the deployments so that a user's profile settings and mobile devices are automatically configured. The giveaway there for me is the last two words, automatically configured. And for automatic configuration, probably the single most critical service there is going to be the Auto Discover service. And that's what I have put in here, just to break down on all four of those services that popped up in that question. We've got to worry about what's happening with the infrastructure. It's going to be on the planning side of it. One of the things you will see if you go take a look at the TechNet site is there's multiple diagrams and white papers on planning for an exchange deployment. Where are you going to put your domain controllers? Planning placement of global catalog servers. What's your rule of thumb when it comes to configuring global cat? What ratio of global catalog server to domain controller do you use? 1:1? Yeah. Yeah, that's considered the best practice anymore. 1:4? You put one global catalog server for every domain controller? Oh, okay. Okay. Yeah, the whole point there is that when you have the global cat, if every single domain controller is going to be a global catalog server, you don't have to worry about the infrastructure master in any of the domains. Yeah, well, there's a checkbox for it. I think, well, I thought it was a checkbox, but you can uncheck it. Yeah, okay. It's been a long week already. My dogs are hurting. All right, so we have to take a look at DNS requirements. Obviously, that's going to be important. SRV records, MX records, preparing domains for exchange, schema changes, plan around the AD site topology. You've got configuring user workload policies. Workload policies, all this stuff having to do with workloads is going to be new. So you're probably going to want to spend a little bit of extra time with that because those really didn't exist to the degree where we've got them today. And then role-based access control. Fortunately, with role-based access control, if you're familiar with that side of it in Exchange Server 2010, I don't think you'll have too much trouble with that component. But one of the things you probably will want to spend some time on is going to be the role-based access control and Active Directory split permissions. That part of it is going to study up on it. You want to focus on what the differences are between the two. There are some differences having to do with primarily the way the server can interact with Active Directory and services as opposed to the way users interact. Creating custom scoped role groups, configuring delegated setups, service level agreements. Get that part of it. That's just the plan for it. So here we go. You're the administrator of an Exchange 2013 organization based in Australia. A recent compliance and security audit has found that many users are inadvertently sending personally identifiable information outside the organization when they reply to and forward emails. You need to ensure that PII is not sent outside the organization. However, customer service representatives often do need to verify PIIs with the customer. The consistent topic that pops up in a question like this is everything having to do with data loss prevention and data loss prevention policies. So this is where it comes up, and there's, you know, breaking it down. My advice to you is become very familiar with data loss prevention policies and how they differ from your traditional hub transport rules that you're used to implementing. So create a data loss prevention policy based on an appropriate PII template for your country. Leave all the default settings. Create a data loss prevention policy based on an appropriate PII template for your country. After testing, change the policy mode to enforced. Create a data loss prevention policy based on an appropriate PII template for your country. Configure a rule in the policy to allow your customer service representatives to override the policy. Then after testing, change the policy mode to enforced. Create a custom DLP policy. Set the policy mode to enforced. And once again, this is where we have to understand how DLP works and how we kick through it. So what I've given you here is just the link to data loss prevention policies. And these have become more and more important. Oh, hyperlinks. You want to continue? Yes. So this breaks down data loss prevention, DLP procedures, policy templates, document fingerprinting, policy tips, and it's an important document. It breaks things down further. This is one of the newer features that you'll find in Exchange Server 2013, but it does require your attention. Another one. You've created a custom management role based on the database's built-in management role, but you do not want users assigned to that role to perform all of the tasks of its parent role. What commandlets would you use to modify the custom role to remove the tasks that role members are allowed to carry out? In this case, we've got a couple of correct parts of this answer. We've got to worry about getting the management role and removing the management role entry. And once again, I've broken that down, all of the answers, into linking you to the PowerShell commandlet appropriate for each of those. Adding management role entries, removing management role entries, new management role assignment, new management role group, and get management role. And this is one of the areas when you're managing roles, you will want to have quite a bit of experience managing this at the PowerShell level, because that's the way it's done. Okay, 342. I've got some time here yet. Let's talk about this a little bit. So topic areas, not quite the straight 25% options that you're used to seeing that we saw in the 341. This one, we've got five different sections. So we've got to worry about configuring, managing, migrating, unified messaging. It is a good idea to have a little bit of what I would tell you to do when it comes to that component. Not only do you want to be familiar with what's happening on the Exchange side of things, it would be in your best interest to read a little bit on how things get addressed on the Link side of things with unified messaging. Having familiarity on both sides is very helpful. Site resiliency, that's once again what I would tell you to check out with some of Scott Schnoll's sessions. Designing, configuring, and managing security, managing compliance, archiving, and discovery solutions, who can do what, and then also coexistence, hybrid scenarios, migration, and federation. I think most of you have got the hint from either the keynote or some of the other sessions you've been to, but hybridization, cloud integration are big topics. So they're areas that we want to spend a little bit of extra time on. We get into unified messaging. Excuse me. We have to worry about our IP gateways. We have to worry about unified messaging. We'll want to work with auto attendance, answering rules, high availability, creating dial plans, assigning dial plans to users, moving users between dial plans, features, protected voicemail. That's something that I'd put a little star beside that topic if I were somebody. Well, I guess that makes me a nobody right now. Yes, I am somebody. I do that. I've got to keep myself entertained too. Unified messaging, mailbox policies, and language packs, bringing those in. You get the troubleshooting part of it with mutual TLS, monitoring calls and call statistics, quality of service. The quality of service part of it is very important, especially when you start integrating with Link. And then SIP communication, once again, an important part of that as well. And then you get into unified messaging, migration strategy, coexistence, mailboxes between sites, SIP gateways, decommissioning a legacy system. So here you get one. You're the unified messaging administrator for your Exchange 2013 organization. Your company's decided that all sales staff should use protected voicemail. What should you do? Create a new UM dial plan called Sales Dial Plan configured with protected voicemail. Within your existing UM dial plan, create a new unified messaging mailbox policy called Sales UM and configure it with protected voicemail. Assign Sales UM to the sales mailboxes. Assign Sales Dial Plan to the sales mailboxes. And there, okay, this should be B and C. So within your existing UM dial plan, create a new unified messaging mailbox policy called Sales UM and configure it for protected voicemail. No, the other one's bold. You can't hard to tell, but this one, C, is bold. So that was my mistake. I was changing all the colors around from going from just the bold white to changing the color to red, and I missed that one. But there we get into unified messaging dial plans. I've given you that link. You've been asked to configure unified messaging for your Exchange 2013 organization. Your company uses Link 2013 Enterprise Voice for telephony. What information do you need to get from the Link administrators to properly configure the unified messaging IP gateway? And in this case, we're going to go with the fully qualified domain name of the Link mediation pool. And I've got a link for you on deploying unified messaging and link server with Exchange. On the site resiliency side, we get into things like database availability groups and working with DAC mode, data center activation coordination, quorum options, cross-site DAG configuration, configuring DAG networks, site resilient CAS solutions with site resilient namespaces, working with and configuring the namespace URLs, site rollover, site failover, and then predict client behavior during a rollover. We get transport information about configuring your MX records, resubmission and rerouting of queries, send receive connectors, as well as transport rollover, and then troubleshooting site resiliency issues, quorum issues, proxy redirection, client connectivity, mail flow, data center activation, and DAG replication. Seems like as we get into the later into the questions, the typeface keeps getting smaller and smaller. You're the Exchange Administrator for Finley Tech's Exchange Organization. You have 280 sites, Omaha and Lincoln. You have multiple DNS servers. You have multiple client access servers in each site. There's a CAS array in Omaha and a CAS array in Lincoln. The internet-facing site is mail.finleytech.com, which is located in Omaha. You need to take precautions to ensure Outlook connectivity will not be interrupted if the Oregon, no, that should be Omaha, the site goes down. And the client, hello, cut out on me there for a second. But what should you include in your disaster recovery plan? And what we get into there is changing the IP address of the A record. If mail.finleytech.com, pointing to the IP address of the CAS2, using repadmin to force replication on the internal DNS servers. And that, I've got an article for you there on high availability and site resilience. Let's see, how are we doing here? You're the Exchange Admin at Finley Tech in the home office in Auckland. Finley Tech has 280 sites, and we can see that. But here we go to the heart of it. You've been asked to provide high availability for the mailbox databases and the sites by using DAGs. What should you do? Choose all that apply. And cutting to the chase on this one, build a DAG that includes mailbox 1 and mailbox 2, using CAS 1 as a witness server, configure CAS 2 as an alternate witness server, then use data center activation coordination mode for the DAG. And we've got links there to help break that down for you. Security side of it, we've got a lot of things there we have to take into consideration when we're securing our messaging environment, starting with things like evaluating role-based access control, working with BitLocker, working with smart cards, making sure that everybody's authenticated, rights management, secure MIME, domain security, and secure TLS. And then with IRM and ADRMS, working with templates, protection rules, Outlook protection rules, transport encryption, configuring IRM for discovery, and then working with pre-licensing for client access. Yeah? Say that. I'm sorry, I can't hear. I wouldn't expect those to show up in the exam for some time. If there is a feature that popped up in, say, the latest service pack, typically it will take, in some cases, 4 to 6 months before you see those questions pop. So it's a good question, because what about new features? What ends up happening with something like that? Those of you that have taken some of these exams before, and I'm sure that's just about everybody in the room, you're probably aware of the fact that when these certification exams come out, there are going to be some questions on the exam that aren't part of the exam. Unfortunately, you have no idea which of those questions, which questions they are. You know, you say, that's a 60-question exam. Well, there's 62. So that means there's two in there that might be trial questions that Microsoft's floating out there to see how people respond to them. That may very well have to do with new features. What I would be inclined to tell you is that if you get a question about something that's really new, that's probably the flag. This question may not actually count, but treat it like it counts, because you never know. You know, they're not going to tell you which. There's not going to be a little, you know, clippy showing up saying this question doesn't count. That is not going to happen. That's the important part, is make sure you get the dance move in there when you do that kind of thing. we had a 300-pound guy doing ballet in class. Troubleshooting, managing certificates, CRLs, those, you got to watch out for those, because there are some services that will not like you unless you have published your certificate revocation list. I found out about that the hard way on a new deployment. Private key availability, IRM and RBAC. So you're the exchange admin for your organization. You need to specify separation of work policies in order to maintain standards and workflows and help to control change in your company. You have the following requirements. Users who are assigned a specific permission in AD will create security principles. User exchange server services will create security principles. That's the giveaway right there. Mailboxes, mail-enabled users, distribution groups, and role groups will be created using exchange tools. Some third-party programs will require that exchange servers be able to create security principles on their behalf. So which model should you use? This one, you got to go with RBAC split permissions. The giveaway for me on this one was that aspect of it where Exchange Server Services will be able to create security principles, because if you go with Active Directory split permissions, you don't have that capability. That's really kind of the giveaway there. So I've given you links to break down those two services. Let's see. You're the Exchange 2013 administrator for your organization. All servers run Exchange 2013. You want to reduce the risk of server impersonation. Which of the following would you use the set send connector commandlet to modify your send connector accordingly? And these are all fairly similar. Let's see, TLS authentication level being addressed on all of them. Certificate validation, domain validation. Domain validation, ignore start TLS. Certificate validation, TLS domain. And what it comes down to is making sure that you've got the TLS domain aspect in there. The giveaway here has to do with domain validation versus certificate validation, TLS domain versus ignore start TLS. So I've given you a link to the send connector commandlet. And lastly, I know there's still one more section left. It's okay. We're almost there. Archiving, archive policies, on-premises archiving, archiving solutions, DLP with pre-built rules, custom rules, DLP solutions, and custom policies. We get into messaging records management, retention policies and custom tags, compliance solutions with ethical walls, mail tips. I'm still thinking I don't want management to know about mail tips. We just sent out 4 new mail tips this week. Message classifications, compliance requirements. So here you're the Exchange admin. You have a single AD named finleytech.lcl. The CIO instructs to apply the following messaging records management settings for the customer service group. What should you do? Choose all that apply. And I have no idea. So here we go. Create a retention policy tag, create personal tags, default policy tags, retention policy tags, personal tags, default policy tag, default policy tag, default policy tag. What it comes down to is that you've got 3 there that are going to be better fits than the others. But it's from Exchange 2007 to 2010, then on to 2013. The idea of how retention policy tags and personal tags worked has all changed. So I would advise you to go check out. Actually, do you know what I think I did? I should have gone apply the retention policy to the service group and create the, so these two down here are part of the answer as well. I thought that didn't look complete. Apply the retention policy to the group, create a default policy tag to limit messages in 365 days. But there is a litany of TechNet articles about retention policies and retention policy tags. It's a big deal, because we used to be real big about using messaging records management and setting up folders that did all that stuff. Now we're using tags instead. And then we've got to make a choice to make about how we're going to deal with the enterprise implementation of these retention policies, and then what are we going to allow users to apply on their own as well. So that's part of that. Another one we've got here, you need to ensure that you're externally facing CAS server has enough resources to support your SLAs for your users. What should you do? And this starts getting into workload policies. You get workload policy, workload policy management, setting and applying workload policies to each of them. So what I would guide you towards, a couple of answers here, new workload policy, external OWA work policy, workload type OWA, workload classification, customer expectation. Oh, are you guys going to love PowerShell after this or not? This is the kind of, this is where we end up, we're doing a lot of it because the whole workload stuff has to be done through PowerShell as well. But that's why I've given you the information on the new workload policies, which also get into the purpose of them and why you would choose to implement them. Let's see. CIO wants you to assign certain users to a group named Findlay Tech Protection. To ensure productivity, you need to make sure the users belonging to this group are able to search mailboxes of users for messages that contain the word spam, patents, infringement, or virus. You know what? That sounds like discovery management to me. You're looking for messages in a within particular mailboxes. Covered that. You need to know about the Federation side of it. Exchange Online, Exchange Federation, working with hybrid configurations. Dealing with the Federation aspect of it as well as on-premises with legacy and cross-force coexistence solutions. Migrating legacy systems from 2007 to 2010, as well as the troubleshooting side of it. And you know what, this is just, we get a few more questions on this. What I really wanted to get to here is, and you can these are all part of my deck, you're welcome to it, but I want to get to the sessions. So among the breakout sessions that you're probably going to want to take a look at, I've mentioned here Outlook Connectivity, Hybrid Exchange Server 2013 Deployment, Public Folder Migration. The three starred sessions that I've got there in the middle are some of Scott Schnoll's sessions. So managing availability, high availability, and tips and tricks. I've been in some of his sessions before, and in the Exchange world, he's a rare talent. We get into performance tuning. There's also migration experiences, which is a nice one for those of you that might have to deal with 2007 and 2010 migrations to 2013. We've got multiple labs, including one that's migrating, working with high availability, data loss prevention, site mailboxes, and archiving and e-discovery center. And, excuse me. There's also members of the Exchange team downstairs on the floor. A couple of things I would mention. I did mention the Exchange, Mastering Exchange Server 2013 book. There's also a good book on PowerShell and Exchange Server 2013. The title escapes me. The name of it, I can't remember the name of it right off the top of my head. Oh, by the way, a couple of other books that I would like to, I have nothing to do with these books, but I am familiar with the authors, and these guys have always written quality content. Tony Redmond has a book out on working with information stores. And I want to say Paul Robichaud's got a book out. Both of these are Microsoft Press. They're inside and out books. Tony Redmond's book is on, it's on information stores, I believe, mailbox databases. What's that? DAGs, yeah. And Paul Robichaud's book is on, like, message transport and connectors. Yeah. Client access. Both of those guys, I recommend without even having my hands on the books to start with. David's book, the Mastering Exchange Server 2013 book, is his second time writing. He also did the Exchange Server 2000, Mastering Exchange Server 2010 book with Jim McBee. And Jim McBee had written the Exchange Server 24/7 books that you saw for Exchange 2007, I believe 2003. So I do like to... I'm a book guy. Reading is something I do all the time, and that's what I end up doing. I'm a trainer, so I read what I can, digest what I can, and regurgitate what I can. And I'm also going to tell you when I don't have the answer, and I'll try and point you in the right direction. What questions do you have? We've got a couple minutes. We have 4 minutes. So I've got my blog up there. I don't have a whole lot up there, but I'm going to try and make sure I get a link so that what I'll end up doing is taking these presentations, I'll load them up to my OneDrive, and then I'll have a link on bobsterism.com so that you can click on that link and it'll open up my folder, public folder. Anybody can download the presentations that I've done today. You had a question? Oh, yeah. In fact, the recommendation, if you're going to start splitting out CAS role and mailbox server role, it's in Exchange Server 2010, the recommended ratio was going to be 3 client access servers for every 4 mailbox servers, if memory serves. In Exchange Server 2013, the recommended ratio is 1 CAS server for every 4 mailbox servers. So that cuts down on the total amount of hardware you have to worry about. And keep in mind, all these can be virtualized too. But yeah, no problem recommending that. Other resources, Channel 9, I should say. Oh, by the way, who's got a Roku box? You got Channel 9 in your Roku? It's available. It's available. My kids they've got not enough to do in the summer, so I steer them towards the Roku box. But I usually have them. I'll watch Channel 9. They want to go over, and I'll make them watch Khan Academy. So, let's see. Learning. Hey, I love it when people are in my class. So, every Microsoft certified trainer loves to see people show up and say hi. And hopefully we can show you some things you didn't know about. TechNet is a resource that I live by. I don't want to say die by. That sounds a little bit morbid. But, I swear by TechNet. There, that's a better way to say it. MSDN for developers. Be sure to take a few moments, fill out an eval. I appreciate it. I hope I've given you some things you can use today. Did I? Okay.